the first on the chopping block. And I think that's a mistake, because I think actually these students are not the diversity students. These students are our students.
Yes.
And they're going to be our future students. And I think that it's very important that all of our strategies and techniques to help them become embedded in our all of our regular operations. So, and I'm sure that a lot of our counseling services do also work with all students, right? But to if we need to change cultures, if we need to change processes, that to create a more welcoming campus, a more open campus, a more flexible campus that can respond to the diversity of our students, that's the work I think that needs to be done.
I just had a conversation, Madam Chair, with Gary Eichten, with Dr. Brunings for an hour, and What I said at that point, representing our trustees, and Tom Rainier is the chairman of the Finance Committee, at this point, as we face this difficult situation, everything's on the table, but students are going to be first. And we're going to try to hold the tuition as best we can, and I assure you that since this money came to us as an investment in this program, it's going to be given every consideration, and I would not want to leave you the impression today that that's going to be whacked off. That is very important. Tom, have I said it the way that the board would be supportive? So thank you for that reminder. And the other thing, if these programs get started and gain momentum, it would be a shame to cut them off. They are expensive, though, ladies and gentlemen. Lots of counseling, lots of support system. But I think the results can be quite remarkable. And I think you ought to grill this group a little bit on how that's all working.
Okay.
But thank you.
All right. Thank you, Chancellor.
Come on, Whitney. Your turn to
come to the grilling chair.
Dr. Whitney Harris. Thank you.
Welcome, Dr. Harris. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Dr. Whitney Harris, Executive Director for Diversity and Multiculturalism at the Minnesota State Colleges and University System. I think Senior Vice Chancellor Linda Baer will start us off this afternoon.
Welcome.
Chair Pappas, I'm Linda Baer, the Senior Vice Chancellor for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Pleased to be here. As the Chancellor said, we are committed to students. We are committed to access and opportunity. And our presentation today will be reflective of that commitment to equal access to higher education for all Minnesotans, including those from the underrepresented communities. We've known for a very long time there's a population that we must serve, and we must serve better than we have been serving. And there's a lot of opportunity to see what kind of programs work. And with the great system we have with the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, we represent 25 colleges, 7 universities across the state, across the kinds of populations that we want to serve even better than ever before. And so the programs you're going to hear about have to do with some of the results from that wonderful investment that you did make in our students and in serving the underserved population better. All I can say is in serving the underserved better, we serve all people better. And so it isn't about just underrepresented that may not see themselves in the picture aspiring to go to college, but it's once we capture their imagination and have them see the success they can have in our campuses, it also helps us serve all students better. We're going to talk a little bit about the board's high level of investment and commitment to this. It's number one on their list of priorities. It's certainly a uniting goal around all of the board members that come from all walks of life, as we do with citizens' boards. The board has 3 other strategic directions that play an important role in this. They include also the high-quality retirement services, the idea of enhancing economic opportunities, and what better time than now to be talking about the role of our colleges and universities in doing just that, and also in finding innovative ways to meet current and future educational needs. So we have the right tools in place, and we certainly appreciate the investment and the commitment that you've put on us to begin to work more systematically towards serving the underserved. And I will turn it over to Dr. Harris to describe some of the programming we've done to date.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much. As we all know, diversity in the Midwest, Wisconsin, Minnesota, certainly is growing. Minnesota looks a lot different. I looked a lot different when I came to work here in 2005 as opposed to when I came here as a student many, many years ago. So diversity really is growing in Minnesota. And we also have to be concerned about what we call the pipeline or the spiral or whatever, however we want to term it, whatever term we want to use, because we know that when we receive students from our K through 12 system. And so part of what I'm going to talk about is going to suggest that we describe some of the relationships and some of the programs that we're engaged in through those partnerships. For example, the Brookings Institute found a wide gap in educational achievement. While 33% of Twin City area residents had a bachelor's degree or higher, only 19% of blacks, 11% of Mexicans, and 8% of Hmongs had reached that level. Now, that has powerful implications not only for those individuals, but for what I like to call the climate or the cushion or the support for seeking post-secondary education. So it has wide implications. Many students in these groups do not graduate from high school, and there's a chart in the packet that shows the rate of high school graduation for various groups. An example would be while white students, the graduation rate is 87%. For American Indians, the graduation rate is 53%, a clear gap in the graduation rate that we are clearly aware of, I'm sure, but has an impact about regarding what we do in secondary education. The programs funded by the underrepresented initiatives represent ways to improve both recruitment and retention of students from underrepresented groups. And I like to repeat what the chancellor said, if you will. Underrepresented students are first generation, low income, and students of color. So we're talking about a rather broad group of students. And as Vice Chancellor Baer stated, this is not a new issue. And to kind of give it some context, we have had successful programs in place for years. What was new for our system and what is new for our system is that the Board of Trustees wanted to develop a systematic and measurable approach to moving the needle, and with emphasis on systematic and measurable, because it's very important that we do it in a way that we can assess outcomes, not just for individual programs, but for the total system. This initiative began in 2001. The first step was to identify students' real and perceived barriers to attending college. Dr. Mike Lopez, Associate Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs, was tasked with that work. He formed a task, and this is a creative moment for us, that included both K-12 educators, college students, faculty, and administrators from our colleges and universities, as well as individuals from the nonprofit world who were engaged in family work, in work around education issues. The task force concluded students often have no role models in their families for attending college, and many parents may not have had the experience that prepared them to help their children to prepare or get ready to go to college, or in many cases, to even see college as an option post-secondary. Other barriers included sometimes college is perceived as too expensive, and there are studies that show that over and over. If you ask the typical person, often that perception of how much a college education would cost is much higher than the reality of that cost. That's not to say it's not costly, but the perception is often much higher. And, of course, they would then write college off. And also, students don't know how to access financial aid. Perhaps most of us in this room would think that's a simple task, but to quote on an example from my Louisiana experience, many people were shocked after Katrina to know how many adults did not have an organic relationship with a financial institution. And I won't go into that, but I suspect that that's more than in Louisiana. So you have the issue of how do you access financial aid under those circumstances. So we looked at what works in our system, 40 or so federally funded TRIO programs and other proven programs. Those practices included several proven programs and experiences that work. Some are bridge programs. The thing to think about then is the TRIO programs, the Upward Bound programs. But that's just one model, but that's an example of what we're talking about. There are also first-year experiences, extended orientation, learning communities, intrusive advising, and supplementary education. And at some point, if we need additional explanations, we could do that. The catch here is that these strategies are labor-intensive and expensive. However, they have a proven track record, particularly as we seek to improve access and success for our targeted groups. We are also engaged in many outreach programs designed to bring an awareness of higher education access and opportunity to underrepresented communities. And I think the chancellor alluded to one of those programs when he talked about Super Weekend. This is the third year that we've done Super Weekend. The goal of Super Weekend is to bring college information to people where they gather. And so we went to 13 communities, made almost 25 presentations, speaking to approximately 2,000 congregants or faith-based people about access and opportunity. But we didn't just speak about it. Through each speaker, each college president, or each senior administrator also brought along the admissions team, which was able to speak with parents and prospective students, and sometimes some real students who still had some issues that they wanted to answer. So this was the third year, and we're doing a third year assessment to see the impact of it, but we're really excited about that. Once we had successful pilot projects, the legislature indicated that $22 million for the FY08-09, and the board approved these funds to continue these kinds of initiatives. Of the $11 million a year, we allocated $7.4 million directly to our colleges and universities in a formula basis that Senior Vice Chancellor Baer is going to explain when she answers the questions that you sent for us to respond to. We also allocated $3.4 million through a competitive process to set up three college access and opportunity centers. And again, those centers, the whole focus of those centers were certainly to continue the work of access and opportunity, of reaching back. They were required to have several components, which included one component, they had to reach back to the secondary schools. They had to collaborate with your local education associations. Another component was a research to continue, and not, I should say, applied research, to continue to access and look for better ways to serve our students. The centers focus on improving students' college readiness. Readiness is so, so very important if we're going to close the gap in higher education. We also earmarked $200,000 to develop recruitment materials, and I hopefully some of you have seen the recruitment materials on our local transportation system, our buses. We're also doing brochures in various languages, a kind of a system-wide approach to awareness. One of our kind of flagship programs, I'm going to step back and ask President Donovan to speak about it. It's the power of you. We also have in our audience another president who participates in that program, and that's President Sue Hammersmith from Metropolitan State. President Donovan is from St. Paul College.
And would President Hammersmith just raise your hand so people can see who you are? She's a new president at Metro State.
Thank you, Whitney. Chair Pappas and committee members, my name is Donovan Switzenberg, and as Whitney said, I'm the president of St. Paul College. And with me today already recognized is Sue Hammersmith, representing Metro State University, and also Beth Yeh, the director of research and assessment for Minneapolis Community and Technical College. The three of us have been involved in the power of you. Thank you for inviting us today to talk about and answer questions about the power of you, which was initiated at the three institutions. We took seriously the charge of our Board of Trustees and our Chancellor to increase the access and opportunity for students. We knew that many students did not believe they could go to college for some real reasons and for some not so real reasons. We set out to destroy the myth and change student perceptions from "we cannot afford to go to college" to we cannot afford not to go to college. The three presidents believed that a career without post-secondary education would be a ticket to a life of poverty for our own children. We also believed that our positions call for us to try to treat children of other people as well as our own. The Power of You program was launched in 2006. Participation in the program guaranteed 2 years of free tuition plus an array of student support services. It was a five-year demonstration project with two primary goals. First, increase enrollment retention and graduation rates for low-income students, and second, increase enrollment retention and graduation rates for students of color. We singled out students of color because of some disheartening data about our community. According to the National Center for Public Policy and Education, the achievement gap among students of color costs the state's economy $1.4 billion each year in lost income. And according to the Citizens League Higher Education Report, only 3% of Black and American Indian ninth graders and 5% of Hispanic ninth graders will earn a bachelor's degree within 10 years. About $5 million was raised for the Power of You project, and we are grateful to the businesses, the foundations, and individuals who were so generous in support of this endeavor. We are also grateful for the $600,000 legislative funding we received for scholarships for the Power of You students. We engaged Wilder Research from the beginning to assure an independent, unbiased report of this project. They have provided a first and second year report. I mentioned earlier that we had three goals related to low-income students and students of color. They were to increase enrollment, retention, and graduation. I would like to address each of these. First, enrollment. There is not a question of the program's success as we look at enrollment. According to the Wilder Research second-year report, enrollment of new Minneapolis and St. Paul High School graduates more than doubled at the three higher education institutions offering the Power of You program. More recent data shows that enrollment has nearly tripled in the three institutions, going from 300 to 879 students. And that's comparing fall 2008 enrollment to before the Power of You was implemented, which would be the fall of 2005 enrollment information. It should be noted that the Power of You students comprise a high percentage of students of color, much higher than the overall percentages of the students of color at any higher education institutions in Minnesota, private, public, or proprietary, including our three institutions, which are the three most ethnically diverse institutions in the state. Our program of U enrollment at the three institutions averages 64% students of color. Based on the Minnesota Higher Education Office fall 2007 enrollment figures, our three institutions enroll almost 25% of all students of color enrolled in higher education in all parts of Minnesota. The Power of You has added to this increase in enrollment. Specifically, Wilder Research cited in their report that in the first 2 years, the number of low-income students enrolled increased by nearly 500 students. And with regard to race, ethnicity, Black and African-American students increased by 350 students. Retention. The most common reporting method for retention is comparing the first fall semester enrollment to the following fall semester enrollment. In other words, how many students started in the fall, how many were still there the next fall. Based on this method, retention rates for the Power of You students were higher than retention rates of comparable cohorts at MCTC, St. Paul College, and Metropolitan State University. The Power of You students' retention rate was higher than the 32-college national benchmark of urban two-year colleges, according to the 2008 National Center for Educational Statistics. And the Power of You students' retention rate was higher than the benchmark retention rates at the two-year institutions comprising the nationally-based Lumina Foundation's Achieve the Dream institutions, with goals similar to the Power of You. Of our three institutions, Metropolitan State University had the highest retention rates for Power of You. Although they have a small number of students, their retention rate was 95%. Graduation. Nationally, the benchmark for graduation at two-year colleges are compared after six semesters, which is 3 years. Our three-year period ends this coming June, so we do not have quality numbers at this time. However, we believe if we enroll three times more students who are much more diverse than our overall student body, and retention is higher than our regular students, it would stand to reason that we should be able to show more graduates at the end of this June to support one of our goals that we believe was important in this project. The question also was is how were we using access funds? We do receive funds from our system. MCTC is using the $390,000 it receives as part of the Access Opportunity and Success Appropriation for Power of You Advisors and to provide specialized student services to other underrepresented students. St. Paul uses the $240,000 it received through the Access Opportunity and Success Allocation to expand outreach, transition, and retention efforts associated with the Power of You, St. Paul Connections and Career Pathways. And Metropolitan State University used their $240,000 to support Power of You and other supportive areas at Metropolitan State University. Although we recognize with the experience that we've had in the few years that we had the Power of You that there are many opportunities for strengthening the program and improving the program, we believe that it has been a successful program and the opportunity should be spread to other communities who are also can advantage themselves of this program throughout the state. We hope to receive consideration for funding for the program, recognizing that we have some outstanding economic problems in the state. We think it's still very important to make sure all students get an opportunity for an education in the state of Minnesota.
President Schwichtenberg, thank you. Do you have any sense, when Wilder did their evaluation, were there any students that were kind of on track to be going to college anyway, but they took advantage of the free tuition marketing?
I would assume there would be some students in that category. We all want to take advantage of opportunities when they presented themselves. But one of the interesting things is in our first cohort, we never took any students into the program until the last part of May. And at that time, all students who are planning on going to college should have plans for going on already. Okay. So these are students who are not going anywhere else. And one of the concerns was, would we take students away from other colleges? Mm-hmm. And that certainly was not our goal, and that's why we chose to take the students on late. These were students, for the most part, the vast majority, they were not going on to college. But it was interesting to note when the Wilder research did their evaluation, one of the questions they asked the students, were you planning on going on to college? And many of those students who had not made any plans by the end of May said, oh, yes, we were. Part of it was kind of a cultural thing. Mm-hmm. You don't want to admit that you don't want to go on to college nowadays.
Mm-hmm. But part of it was they could have had it in their idea they wanted to go to college, but they had no idea how to go about it.
No plans, nobody supporting them, no map to follow.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schwichtenberg, you gave a 95% retention rate for Metro State, and you said that was a small group of students. What was the retention rate at the other two colleges, and do you have any information? You were saying that those retention rates compared favorably to other similar programs, but how does it compare to a cohort that wouldn't be in the program like that of regular students?
Madam Chair, thank you. I gave the Metropolitan State University, I mentioned that it was a small number. They have a small number of students, but have 95%, which probably is better than anybody else in the whole United States. But for our colleges, MCTC, the regular cohort retention rate is 57%. And the Power of You students was 64%. St. Paul College, the regular cohort, was 43%. The Power of You student retention rate was 62%. So the Power of You students did a much better job than our regular students, but part of it was because of the array of extra services that is available to them. And you probably could make the jump to, if our regular students had more help and more extra services, their retention rate would probably be even higher.
Did you provide a summer bridge program for these students to help them prepare for college, or are they taking remedial courses during the regular year?
Madam Chair, Minneapolis had an excellent bridge program for the 2 years. St. Paul had a partial one for 1 year. Both schools provide remedial opportunities for students in math and reading, which is important because one of the things that we found, if we look at national research across the country, students who go on to college who need remedial services, if they're not available, 85% of those students will drop out of college within 1 year after they start. So those are an important array of services that we offered to the students.
But my question was it offered in the summer, or was it during the when they could during the regular year, and they're using up part of their 2 years taking remedial courses.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. The Bridge Program, many of us had one for 2 years in the summer. St.
What do you mean 2 years in the summer? Between
during two summers. I'm
the
sorry.
Summer before
this
the freshman
is the third year,
and then the summer between
the
freshman
summer
and
before they started.
Okay.
There was a Bridge Program the summer before they started. Uh-huh. During the school year, students are in remedial courses, and those are courses that do not count towards their graduation, which is one of the reasons we do not have solid graduation numbers at this point, because a number of students have to complete their remedial programs before they take the other classes, and therefore that delays their graduation rate at the end.
Right. So isn't it better for them to take the summer Bridge Program, or is that not enough?
Madam Chair, it is better for them to take the summer Bridge Program, but it is not enough for a number of students.
Okay. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We had a big discussion about college readiness in E-12 yesterday. And I'm wondering, when you have these students that need remediation, do you usually find that they simply haven't taken the appropriate courses, or that they've taken them too early in their high school years and have not retained the information? Has there been any study done on who's taking those courses and how well they may or may not have been prepared in high school?
Madam Chair.
President Schwickenberg.
Senator, I do not have a study that would indicate what the reason. I know that in our experience, it's a wide variety of reasons. Some of the students who come into the Power U did not apply themselves well enough in high schools. Some of the students did not take remedial work that they probably should have. Some of the students did not succeed in some of the classes as well as they perhaps could have. So it's a wide variety of reasons. I don't have a concrete or a reason to give you as to why they are not as successful as they should have been or could have been.
President Schwickenberg, do you remember from the study how the Power of U compared with the regular college students in terms of their grades and in terms of course completion?
Madam Chair, I do not recall. I gave you the retention rates. I don't have that information that you're asking.
Okay. Do you think it's in the report?
It may be.
In the report. Okay.
If I may ask Beth Ye, would you happen to know the answer to that question?
It would be in the report. The GPA would be in the credits earned or also in the report.
It would be in the credit.
It's in the report.
In the
Does anyone happen
report,
to recall what it is from the report? Beth, do you recall?
You want to come up?
Madam Chair, I'm Dr. Beth Ye from Minneapolis Community Technical College. I'm the Director of Institutional Research. If I may just take a moment to find the page in the Wilder Report. Are you asking for the GPAs of the students?
GPAs would be fine.
Okay.
And kind of course completion, if you have that.
Okay. So with the GPAs, for Minneapolis Community and Technical College, for the Power of U students, the combined 2006 and 2007 Power of U cohort, their combined GPA was 2.28 in the fall of their first year and 2.29 in the spring of their first year. And the comparison cohort of recent high school graduates who attended Minneapolis Community Technical College in 2004 and 2005, so prior to the start of the Power of U, their GPA in the fall of their first year was 1.96, and in their spring of their first year, 2.28.
Are you just comparing any group of students, or do you match a group of students of kind of first-generation students, similar backgrounds, et cetera?
This is the work that the Wilder evaluation did, Wilder Research did, and they chose peer groups of recent high school graduates who attended, in that example that I gave, Minneapolis Community and Technical College.
The previous years.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And then do you also know about course completion?
Course completion.
While she's looking that up, does anyone else have a question? So we don't put so much pressure on her to find it.
Yep.
Okay.
For course completion rates, again, if I may follow the Minneapolis Community College example, for the combined Power of U cohorts, their credits earned in the first fall was 8.98, and in the first spring averaged 7.74. The combined peer recent high school graduate cohorts in 2004 and 2005, for the fall it was 6.93, and for the spring it was 7.46.
Okay.
Just first year.
All right. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Take a little closer look at that report. Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, for anyone, do you use the MARS number for students that participate in your programs, and the MARS being the number assigned, if they're Minnesota residents at least, through the accounting reporting system, and then try to draw some conclusions regarding how well they did, and then looking back and any patterns and conclusions that you would draw?
Chair Pappas and Senator Wieger, first, the MARS number follows a K-12 student, and it's only been recent that we have moved towards a MARS number that can follow from K-12 into colleges and universities. What we do, though, is a report about getting prepared that does track every student that comes from every high school to a college or university that requires developmental. And we send that report back to the school principals and superintendents of those schools. So we aren't at that place yet of the MARS number traveling from K-12 over to college, but we're ready to go with that now. And actually, I think the Minnesota Office of Higher Education folks could speak to that more.
If they could,
but
when will we be there for the integration of the MARS number so we can get better
data? Senator Pappas and Senator Wieger, I believe that we have passed through the hoops, so to speak, to be able to begin that work now. We had to work through some data privacy and issues that crossed over the district and the college boundaries, but that we are ready now to begin to do that.
So, Madam Chair, it is being implemented. You're ready, and it's being implemented.
Senator Pappas and Senator Wieger, I would like further clarification from the Minnesota Office of Higher Education about the actual launch of that.
Okay, and they're on the agenda.
Okay, thanks.
Awesome. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wanting to go back to the course completion because I'm trying to figure out how this works with the Power of U. If they're completing about 17 credits a year, that's only about half, or yeah, 17 credits a year is only about half of what you would need in 2 years to get a degree. Am I right about that? So are the students able to enroll until they get their degree, or is it just those first 2 years?
Good question.
Madam Chair, Senator, when we started the program, we knew that many of our students were going to need remedial assistance. So we guaranteed the tuition for them for 2 years plus extra credits for the remedial work so that they would be allowed to go more than 2 years to allow for them time to take the remedial classes to enable them to be more successful in the other classes.
So, Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
So if they're only getting about half the credits they need a year to graduate what we would consider on time, you would extend that so a student could actually stay there for 4 years and do this on a part-time basis? Or I'm just trying to figure that out.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, there was a defined number of credits that they could enable themselves of for the remedial area, and they would not be allowed to take credits that would go beyond probably for sure three years. So if we recognize that some students would take 3 years to complete.
But your students are required to go full-time?
Madam Chair, they're required to be considered a full-time student. A full-time student is a student taking 12 to 15 credits per semester.
So, Madam Chair, so then they're completing, their course completion is quite a bit less than that. Each one of them is completing either 8.98 or 7.74, so they are not completing 12 credits a semester.
Is that because the remedial? Especially the first semester, I imagine they're taking, if they're taking all remedial, then they would be a semester behind, but then maybe the second year they catch up. That's my guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator.
Could you tell me your name again?
Yes, Elizabeth Yeh.
Yeh. Okay, thank
Correct.
You.
I've had time to find my summary of the Wilder Report, which has helped me to kind of summarize the numbers. With the cumulative credits earned, I would just like to show my summarized numbers. I think that will help clarify what I said previously. For the Power of You group, when we're combining the 2006-2007 cohort, at the end of year one, Wilder found that the average credits earned were 20.28, and at the end of year two, the average credit earned were 45.69. So that's the Power of You combining the two cohorts, the fall of 2006 and fall of 2007. In comparison, the peer comparison group, which are the Minneapolis and St. Paul high school students who – recent high school grads who were currently enrolled but not in the Power of You, at the end of year one, their average earned credits were 18.84, and at the end of year two, it was 39.13. So that amends the previous credit earnings that I
And you're assuming we should assume that this peer group also was taking some remedial courses?
Yes, Wilder found that they were also taking remedial courses, sometimes not to the extent of the Power of You students who tended to be more underprepared.
Okay, did you guys have anything else you wanted to share with us, Minskew panel?
Chair Pappas, if you wanted any discussion of the questions that you sent to us ahead of time, including what was the formula basis for the allocation
yes.
of these funds, you do have at your place the report of how the distribution of funds went to each of the campuses and the specific projects each of them are doing at this point. So that
why did
you
decide to do a formula rather than based on what maybe the campus, composition of the campus in terms of diversity was?
Chair Pappas, basically we believed we needed a two-part formula. One had to do with half of the weighting being the student enrollment at each of the colleges and universities, and half of it based on the numbers of underrepresented students. So it was a little bit of the larger population, as well as making sure every campus had a chance to address underrepresented. So we could have had a considerable amount in our larger institutions and less at the smaller, but we find our smaller campuses, as represented in Minnesota West, for example, have a considerable amount of investment they need to begin to make in underrepresented students.
Okay. And then were they supposed to initiate programs that also were kind of research-based, that these were the effective programs?
Chair Pappas, correct. We put a template around which certain projects must be addressed within a choice of two or three or four kinds of things that we knew were proven projects. So we had a duality going of recruiting people who hadn't been recruited before, because this was about bringing new students to the colleges and universities, as well as retaining them. And what this provided for us then was a wide array of data to begin to say, and these are working best for these populations, or this is working better for another population.
Okay. So did I have other questions that you wanted to address?
Chair Pappas, one that might be good is to reference, you were asking what kind of programs particularly worked, and I think we've spoken to that, and you're seeing it in your handout, but what we did would have been projects around readiness and what is it to be ready. So we're trying to work on the pipeline so there is less remediation needed, that there's more understanding of these students. And I would say to Senator Roebling's question, when the state universities and the University of Minnesota went to mandatory prep standards to be enrolled in the universities, students changed their course-taking behavior. Our issue is we still have open access to our colleges, technical colleges, for the fact that you need to graduate from high school and you can come in. Mm-hmm. What we have been working on in the P16 group is better understanding that graduation from high school has to parallel better ready success for college. Therefore, more students have to be taking the math and the science and the reading and the comprehension courses that help them be more ready. Therefore, we can begin to reduce the need for remediation. So that's one part of what we're working on here. The second part is recruiting and getting the right people out there, as was our Super Sunday project. You know, we're here for you. You can see yourself in this picture. There are people like you in these schools, and they're going to be supported when you come to our campuses. So the retention part is the tool, the two part of what we're at. So we work on early readiness messaging. We work on early alert system, a warning alert system. We're watching students better in this group, as we do in the TRIO federal program, to say, there are indicators when you're in trouble. If you're not showing up, or if you're not coming to study tables, or if you're not coming to your advisor, we know that's a warning signal. Get on board and connect. We also do learning communities, which we're finding peer groups, smaller peer groups of students together. They become a peer group of themselves to help them move forward and stay connected. So somebody's paying attention when you're not there. So those are some of the things we found that have been tried and true. And somebody mentioned, I think it was Dr. Harris, Achieving the Dream. Lumina Foundation has gone after specific projects that are tried and true to assist people to be better ready and successful in college. Those are what we're paralleling here. We're asking our colleges create these kinds of interventions to better prepare and succeed for our students.
Would you say that all your campuses have partnerships with their local high schools so that they are also providing college information to the students, plus communicating with those high schools about college readiness?
Chair Pappas, absolutely. Every one of our colleges and universities works squarely with, they know in their enrollment management work, which high schools happen to be the most likely to bring the students to that college or university. So they have a first tier of most likely to attend and a second tier, because our students often apply at more than one place. Also, currently, our students are going to more than one place at the same time. But one is getting the information to them about being prepared and being ready and how to do financial aid and those kinds of things. The second piece is with our technical and career education, the Perkins Grant, which is a federal grant that comes to us to help better bridge between high school and colleges. That interest in career and technical is even a bigger partnership between our school districts and our colleges to better prepare students for what's going to happen in college.
Okay. Senator Roble.
Thank you. Ms. Barrett, I saw you perk up when I asked that question before about whether or not students were not taking the right courses in high school, or if they were taking them too early and not retaining the information that they had gained in those courses in their earlier years of high school. And I'm wondering, have you some information on that, or have you looked into that?
Have I?
Vice Chancellor Baer.
Okay, thank you. Chair Pappas and Senator Roebling, yes. Basically, what we're finding is it's the course-taking patterns. If the last time you took math was eighth-grade algebra, you come in to college, and there are very few courses that don't require, in fact, I would say there are probably no courses, that don't require at least the entry-level math, you're not going to place into college-level math. So part of our problem is students thinking, I don't have to take math anymore. Way back to eighth-grade algebra, they don't have math capabilities when they come into a placement test. So most of the time, it's they have not taken the courses because they haven't been required to take the courses. Back to the universities, though, to get into our universities, and you've just heard the president of the University of Minnesota say, they're not going to require 4 years of math. We're at 3 years of math, which was the agreed-upon prep between the universities. They're going to go to four. Our concern, and we've been in dialogue about this, why don't the state universities go to four? Well, we're serving so many rural communities that 3 years is what they can do right now. They don't have a fourth year, which is basically getting into the calculus or pre-calculus. to be able to serve in some of the rural communities. So we're trying to be very careful that we're not disadvantaging our rural communities and some of our students because of not being able to access the courses.
Okay, thank you very much. We need to move on. But I appreciate that. Was excellent. Very informative. Mr. Paquel. And do you want to bring up the three people?
John,
yeah, okay.
Lannery, are you on
the other panel?
Okay, sure.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm going to lead off for us, if you don't mind.
Okay.
My name is Luis Mendoza. I'm an Associate Vice Provost in the Office for Equity and Diversity. And I'm joined today by Bob McMaster, Vice Provost and Dean for Undergraduate Education, and Kent Paquel, Executive Director of the College Readiness Consortium. Thank you for the opportunity to share information on our outreach and support programs for low-income, first-generation students and students from diverse backgrounds, not mutually exclusive categories by any means, of course. Vice President and Vice Provost for Equity and Diversity, Rusty Barcelo, sends her regrets, but she had a prior engagement that took her out of town. I know she would have really appreciated the opportunity to speak with you. The university is very committed to ensuring that we recruit, retain, and support and graduate a diverse student body, one that provides opportunity for first-generation college students and which reflects the increasingly diverse composition of the state, not just at the present, but one that matches the demographic projections that reveal we will increase this diversity will increase rapidly over the next few decades. I want to provide you an overview of the access and outreach programs initiatives overseen by the Office of Equity and Diversity, including the number of students we serve, the costs associated with these programs, and some information on how we continually assess and modify them as needed to ensure effectiveness and efficiency. Bob and Kent will discuss other important university-wide initiatives. If you will, just briefly, I'll want to refer to some of the handouts, in particular the print handouts, as well as these brochures. The larger brochure, one of them you can take some time to review at your leisure, is a vision framework for equity and diversity at the university that we've just launched this year, which we are in the process of implementing. It's quite detailed. I won't refer to it today. And the other one is a 2008 equity and diversity update, which is a report to our stakeholders. The printouts reveal a couple of things that I just want to point to very quickly. And one is, if you look at the charts, the top one is a graph of the system-wide enrollment by ethnicity comparing fall 2000 and fall 2008. And what we'll see is that we have had some success in recruiting larger number of students from diverse populations. These are still not where we want to be, but there is demonstrated increase in these areas. The second chart is a chart related strictly to the Twin Cities campus, and it shows the five-year retention and graduation rates for students who matriculated in fall 2000 and 2003. And again, we're happy to report in most areas some improvement, still with students from historically underrepresented groups, such as African Americans and Latinos, we still have and American Indians. We still have some challenges there, but we are happy to show some improvement in those rates. And based upon that, I guess I want to make the point that our access and outreach programs are overseen on particularly at the Twin Cities campus, by the Multicultural Center for Academic Excellence. And so a number of the programs I'm going to talk about take place there, though that is not all that our office does. We approach diversity on campus in an effort to ensure that all populations on campus, whether be they a gender, sexuality, disabled students, have the opportunity to succeed. So this speaks specifically to historically underrepresented groups. MK, which is an acronym for Multicultural Center for Academic Excellence, develops and fosters inclusive learning opportunities for undergraduate students through educational support programs, community engagement, cultural activities, and campus-wide collaborations. Now, it's really important to understand that our programs operate on sort of the principle of fostering a culture of collaboration and a culture of belonging, which is very important for underrepresented groups in such a large campus to feel that they have a place there. So many of ours operate sort of using a cohort model in which we bring in students through our various programs and have them take classes together. We have them work with faculty mentors. We have them we also want to promote the principles and values of civic engagement. So oftentimes they are doing mentoring in the high schools or mentoring with peer mentors on campus. So that's very important as well. So MPE offers a sort of a holistic delivery of academic and cultural programs focused on addressing college preparedness, college retention, and college graduation in multicultural communities. So realizing one unit cannot do all this alone, we work with a partner with many units across campus, from various academic departments, student organizations, student affairs, admissions, and through outreach to communities in the greater metro area. In addition to the programs that I'm going to talk about in more detail here in a moment, it's important to understand that MK also offers instructional centers for the various cultural groups on campus that offers tutoring and computer centers and a wide array of student support services, including referrals to other support programs on campus, travel grants, academic and cultural support for scholarship recipients, and recognition and cultural celebration events. So all this is to create, in a way, to shrink the campus environment, to create a more intimate environment for our students. We have a staff of 16 professionals, 2 graduate students, 9 student office workers, and 15 student peer tutors. About 34% of the U's total student of color population have participated in MK programs. In addition, over 100 white students participated in MK programs. None of our programs are exclusive of any group to participate in, and we find that our program is often very much attractive to students from across the various campus groups. A total of 1,624 individual students utilized services offered at MK's main office this past year. This number does not include participation in programming and events across campus. The computer set had 4,304 student visits last year, registering the highest use of any of the official U computer labs. The tutoring center saw 204 individual students for a total of 581 contacts during fall 2008. Students received tutoring for 84 different university courses. All in all, MK's budget for FY09 is $1,000,000 and approximately $17,000, with 80% of that budget used for salaries and 20% for programming. One of the other handouts I have talks about some of our specific programs. Of MK's access and outreach programs, there are numerous ones that build a pipeline. One is UConnects, or Kids on Campus, which brings K through 8 students to campus to participate in educational and outreach programming designed to make the students feel like they have a place at the university. It primarily serves students of color living in poverty or from immigrant communities, first-generation students. The average number of students brought to campus each year is 1,000. There are a number of other departments on campus, such as Chicano Studies and American Indian Studies and African American Studies, that also have their own outreach programs to bring high school students to campus and begin to build relationships with them. There's also the Maridazi program, which is a program funded by from the Office of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education in partnership with the St. Paul Public Schools, focused on cultivating college ambitions, university ambitions for American Indian students in the St. Paul Public Schools. There is also the Multicultural Excellence Program, which is also in partnership with the St. Paul Public Schools, in which students are chosen in seventh grade and receive programming to prepare them for admissions to college. MEP students who attend the university receive scholarships and academic programming, and staff members make a connection with students starting their ninth grade year to maintain a close relationship to help make sure that pipeline is fulfilled. We log about 3,000 contacts with students annually, and the average retention rate through 4 years of the University of Minnesota is about 55%. I will say that we are considering a proposal to the central administration to modify this so it's not geographically bound, and we can target talented middle-income and low-income students throughout the state. So right now it's limited to St. Paul, but we're seriously considering revising it to deal statewide. There's also the multicultural mentoring programs, which is a civic engagement program and a citizen scholar program, which provides opportunities for students to work in community centers in the metro area. They work in literacy centers and other programs. They have to maintain a certain GPA, and they receive some compensation for their work. The average number of students involved in this is about 400 per year. MK persistence programs include programs that are designed to offer multicultural classes in which they have close relationships with U faculty. On average, 83% of the students return from their sophomore year. Again, this shows for us the importance of students taking a curriculum that meets their realities, and it's very important for them. All in all, those about 170 students per year are supported through those classes. We have the President's Distinguished Faculty Mentor Programs, which links students with faculty members. In the last few years, out of 104 students who've participated, only one student is no longer at the U of M. So this is a very strong program we're very proud of, and it connects students to all kinds of research opportunities, including the UROP, MSROP, McNair, U of M libraries and honor scholarships, and the Community of Scholars programs, as well as others. It primarily focuses on underrepresented and first-generation students. It brings in a cohort of 40 a year, and they operate in a two-year cycle, so there's 80 students in that program a year. We also have living and learning communities. These are primarily done through the American Indian Studies Program and the Chicano Studies Department in collaboration with MK. And these, again, bring in students in cohorts of about 20 who reside together in close proximity in the dorms. They take classes together. It promotes civic engagement. They have to do a community service project. And it builds community amongst them, helps them build one-on-one relationships with faculty, and connects them intimately to MK support services. So this has proven very successful. We're actually graduating our first cohort in Casa Sol out of the Department of Chicano Studies, and we find that every year the application pool is getting larger and larger. So I'll pause there for now and turn to Bob to ask him to talk about their program.
For just a minute, sure. Mr. Mendoza. So for the roughly 8,000 students of color that attend the university every year, how many of them actually have a contact with the Multicultural Center, and how do they get that? I mean, are they recruited? Do they have to apply to be involved in one of these programs or activities?
Fairly extensive outreach is done. I think there was this – I don't work directly with that office, but I think that we believe that it's about close to 50% of the students of color have some contact with MK programs.
Did you say 50%?
Yes. Well, the ones at the University of Minnesota campus, this is based primarily there. There are support services for students of color at the other campuses, but these are somewhat decentralized, so they operate their own programs. And MK participates in the university-wide orientation, has a role there, but it also sponsors its own orientation each year for students of color, and it's been extremely successful. They are connected with all kinds of advising services. Mm-hmm. They also send out brochures to each of the college and ask them to distribute them to academic units to let students know that these services are there. So there's extensive outreach that takes place throughout the year.
Is there any kind of special efforts that go on with students that are there on the Founder Scholarship?
We have a relationship with some of those students because many of them are also able to tap into some of the other scholarship programs we offer. And so those students get extra academic support services through MK.
Okay, any questions? Okay, why don't you continue?
Okay, thank you. My name is Bob McMaster. I'm the Vice Provost and Dean of Undergraduate Education at the university. And I wanted to walk the committee, Madam Chair and members, with two programs we have at the university for access. One is the Access to Success program. These are included in the handout that we gave you. And the other is the Bridge to Academic Excellence. The ATS program that we have is brand new. We just started this program this year. It's really a continuation of the students that would have gone previously to General College. In the ATS programs, there's several of them are designed to serve students who have demonstrated strong potential to succeed, but whose high school records in terms of standardized scores have not matched the typical profile. So that's kind of the profile of those students. What is the ATS program? Well, it's a program that is embedded in three different colleges, the College of Education and Human Development, CEHD, in CLA, College of Liberal Arts, as well as CFANS, the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Sciences. And each one of these colleges has a somewhat unique program, a unique curriculum for the ATS students in that college. And I'll explain that in just a moment. The students are selected for ATS status through the admissions process. That is, in the general admissions process, they go through the criteria and identify a set of students who would be appropriate for the ATS. The table that we provide shows you the numbers and some of the general statistics for the ATS group. Again, they fall in the columns into three different colleges, CLA, CEHD, and CFANS. The total number that we brought in fall 2008 included 441 students. Within CEHD, some of those students are assigned in the TRIO program. We target about 100 for TRIO, about 50 for the Commanding English program within CEHD, and then 50 more for the general students in CEHD. CLA brings in 224. And then CFANS has a much smaller program, about 25 to 30. They had 32 students this year. We show you the percent students of color across the different colleges in the total, which is 66% students of color in the ATS program, and then some of the general statistics in terms of entrance information on these students, the average ACT and high school rank. Just a bit about each one of the programs quickly. In the CFANS program, and because each one of these is quite different, students get completely integrated into the CFANS curriculum, although they all take a freshman seminar, and the freshman seminar is targeted towards ATS students. There's particular content, ATS-appropriate content, in those courses. These students also work intensively with the Smart Learning Commons, and I don't have to explain that because I know you were over at the Smart Learning Commons in Walter Library earlier this week, but SMART plays a critical role with some of the gateway courses and tutoring in the gateway courses for these students. The next slide talks about the CEHD model ATS. And in this case, the students all take a common first semester course around a book, a discussion around a book. And in the fall, the book was An Ordinary Man, which was the book that eventually became the movie, excuse me, Hotel Rwanda. Within CEHD, students get intensive support from advisors, and again, they're assigned to one of three groups, TRIO, Commanding English, and General CEHD. Now, CLA takes a different approach to educating the ATS students, and again, this is really a work in progress. The ATS students are assigned to a learning cohort in CLA, and they are included in one of seven advising communities. These include health and natural sciences, arts, social sciences, and so on. So students take a track of courses in one of those seven areas, as well as they take, and this is detailed on the next slide, a set of courses in common. In the fall, they take a writing course, and they take CLA 1005, which is Learning Arts or Liberal Arts Learning. In the spring 2009, right now, they're taking Education and Responsible Citizenship altogether, and then writing 1301. They're also attached with the Smart Learning Commons. So we only have one semester worth of data on the ATS students now, and the results I show you are from CLA. And in the first column, you see the non-ATS students in CLA. In the second column, the ATS students. And we're pretty pleased with the results of this program this year. The students completed nearly 14 credits apiece, not quite. On average, and their GPA, their fall GPA, was 2.94. So we think that, and the results are similar in the other two colleges, we're seeing what we think is a good success with this program.
And Dean McMaster, the students you're comparing here, this is just the kind of the general population. You're not comparing them to a similar cohort.
Right. These would be in the first column, all the non-ATS students in CLA, in the College of Liberal Arts, all of them. And CLA brought in about 2,700 students. The next slide shows you some of the financial support for this program. My office provides support in terms of advising and peer mentoring. You can see the allocations that we make to the different colleges. Most of the cost of this is really embedded in the college itself, though, in the general instructional costs. These colleges are teaching these courses anyway, and the students are in these courses. So ATS is really not significantly impacting our budget other than the allocations that I make here. The second program I'll quickly describe is the Bridge program. I provide here the program mission statement for Bridge. It's an exciting transitional program designed to prepare recent high school graduates for the academic rigor of the U of M. It truly is a bridge program. We try to bring in at-risk high school students and by the fall make sure they're college ready. And it really raises the bar, we think, among these students. It's a residential program. Students come. They spend the summer, 6 to 7 weeks at the university taking classes, and then they're tracked throughout the entire year with additional advising and additional support.
So they come between their junior and senior year?
No, they come after their senior year.
After their senior year. So they're tracked during their freshman year.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. I provide some of the characteristics of this program. This program, Bridge Program, includes 80 students, some athletes within that. And again, the students complete 6 or 7 credits in that first summer, which really gives them a true head start in terms of credit completion.
Well, they get credits for this.
They do.
So it's not
academic
credit. Remedial.
These are not remedial courses. I provide some of the statistics for the first Bridge cohort that came in summer 2007. So they're about now a year and a half into their academic programs. We have the data for the first full year. There were 69 who got through the whole year. They passed 39 credits, which is great. That's 9 more than one would have expected by the beginning of their sophomore year. So that's great. And you can see their GPA, which is 2.8. I then provide the basic budget for Bridge, which is $400,000 a year. 160 cycles through because the provost office pays the tuition, CEHD collects the tuition, and then they give it back to us. So it's a circle of tuition that goes on. But the overall cost of running it is about $400,000. So those are the two programs that kind of fall under my direction.
Dean McMaster, Mr. Mendoza, I don't know if you're a doctor or not. Dr. Mendoza, talked about in the MCAE program, there is a they have a way of connecting kids to the campus. This you talked about is a summer bridge program. Are there other, do you know, just in general at the university, are there other ways that the university is reaching out to high schools and lower to for college awareness?
I would say that there are dozens, literally dozens of outreach programs by the individual units as well as at the college level. I know that the College of Liberal Arts has a staff, particularly who that's her role, is to a K-12 person. Mm-hmm. So they are thinking, and there are also other programs such as College in the Schools, which university professors are teaching courses in the high schools, and then there is the what's the other one called?
PSEO.
PSEO, yes, where the students come to the campus to take classes, the advanced students. So there is, I couldn't tell you raw numbers, but there is a numerous outreach because I think that the message has been sent that outreach, even though there are some centralized efforts, it also has to be decentralized, and this is a recruitment mechanism to send the message earlier so that students can see where they might fit in the university and think very early on, because we know data tells us that by middle school they are already thinking about whether or not they're going to be going to college or not.
Just one further comment on that, Chair Pappas, which is our admissions office with Wayne Ziegler spends a lot of time working with the high schools, mm-hmm. trying to get the high schools informed as to the requirements at the university. So mm-hmm. he has a very deep network with counselors and others in high schools.
Okay, Mr. Pakel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kent Pakel. I'm executive director of the College Readiness Consortium at the University of Minnesota. And in fact, your question is timely, Senator, because that is exactly what my job is. As you know, I'm a card-carrying K-12 person. I was a teacher and an administrator in high school, teacher, administrator, in fact, and I'm now at the university working on that issue on the front end. And I might suggest that we really face two challenges. We face the challenge to help students navigate the system that we've got much more effectively, but we also face the challenge of changing the system, which is to say the K-12 system, which was designed to send no more than about 20% of our students historically on to higher education. And we know that we need today to send many, much higher numbers of our students on to some form of post-secondary education after high school and be sure they're ready to succeed when they get there. One way I like to capture the crystallize that change is if you just think about the phrase college material, it really implies that college is encoded in the DNA of some kids and not others. Or the phrase prep schools. If only some schools are prep schools, what are the other schools? So really at the crux of my work is working in partnership with the K-12 system to turn the battleship so that we have all students pointed toward post-secondary education. Let me give you 3 brief glimpses of how we're working on that. As you know, President Brunich chairs, and my team and I have the opportunity during his tenure as chair to coordinate the Minnesota P16 partnership. That's where we're working in collaboration with 20 other organizations to integrate college readiness expectations into our K-12 academic standards, which, quite surprisingly to many, they were never designed to do at all. We've completed that process in language arts and math, and we're in the guts of it in science. We're also working to the issue that Senator Wieger raised earlier, and that also touches on Senator Roebling's question, to actually create a longitudinal data system that would link student information through K-12 and into higher ed. I'd be glad to talk with, about that in greater detail. My estimate, Senator, is that if we put our nose to the grindstone and get a major federal grant we've submitted that we'll hear about next month, we could actually have a system in 18 months, which is to say not the capacity to do studies, which is you could go off to the Office of Higher Ed or the Department of Ed, but the need to aggregate those data sets in a data warehouse and create a way for legislative staff and, most importantly, practitioners to get at that data. And I'd be glad to talk more about that as you're interested. So the P16 piece is attempting to change the policy frame. Second effort that I want to briefly mention is something that we've created in partnership with the state of Minnesota and our administrators' associations called the Minnesota Principals Academy. The picture that summarizes what we do over the course of a year with school principals from rural, urban, and suburban, elementary and senior high, charter and district schools is summarized on this graphic. We spend 25 days with them working on how they create schools in which every kid is on the path to college readiness. We are currently running a cohort on the Iron Range. We're running one in southern Minnesota. And as it was announced in the paper today, we've just received funding to launch a cohort that jointly is bringing Minneapolis and St. Paul Public Schools principals together to go through this executive development program. Let me give you three brief glimpses of the impact that that program has had on college readiness. At Richfield High School, the principal went through this program, went back, looked at her mathematics data, and found that they had three entire tracks of math: general math, English language learner math, and consumer math, none of which took students above Algebra 2 through the course of their entire high school career. We know that every step you go beyond Algebra 2 doubles your chances of completing a BA. And so they got rid of those tracks because they realized they couldn't afford to have academic low roads if students, if they're serious about post-secondary education. Second example, at South High School in Minneapolis, they realized that they had prerequisites for getting into their college prep coursework: credit requirements, GPA requirements, teacher approvals, that were keeping that track a hermetically sealed bubble within the school to kids who wanted to make the effort. They got rid of those requirements and put in new support mechanisms. And at Wayzata High School, they realized that they needed to go to double periods of math for students who were struggling in mathematics that's critical for post-secondary success. I would submit that during the years when I was teaching high school, if a kid was struggling in college prep math, our solution was to just take them out of that math track. It wasn't to give them additional support. Well, you're not a math person. And so that is a glimpse of how we're trying to really flip the switch through the Principals Academy. And finally, we're trying to work also at the student and family level with an effort called Ramp Up to Readiness. This is a partnership with the Office of Higher Education and the Bush Foundation, and this really is an effort to make sure that students have the knowledge and signals they need to act on the fact that they want to go on to higher education. And in closing, Madam Chair, let me share with you, actually this morning, I got some survey data on the 11 schools that we're working in this year. Those schools are actually listed on page 7. I got some survey data on what we're learning from those students, and they nicely illustrate the goals not only of this program but of some of the challenges that we face in the work of college readiness. We have four critical areas in which Ramp Up to Readiness is focused: expectation, preparation, investment, and access. This is data, and if our evaluator was here now, she'd have an aneurysm because I'm using it with you, and it's not ready for prime time and publication. But this is survey data from those 11 schools, and I think it's an interesting point on which to conclude. When we ask students in those schools listed on page 7, and it is not all students in all schools. In some schools, it's a subset of students. In some cases, in particular, students that are underrepresented in higher education. When we ask students, "I plan to go on to college immediately after high school," 88.9% agreed or strongly agreed in our schools. When we asked those students, "My family or guardian expects me to continue my education after high school," 96.9% agreed or strongly disagreed. Our kids want to go on, and their families want to go on, and yet for 30 years in the United States, our post-secondary completion rates have been flat. So our aspirations are not resulting in higher attainment. Our second component of ramp-up is preparation, and I think Senator Robing asked a question about rigorous course-taking. I do have some data on where Minnesota stands with that, and I'd be glad to talk about that as it's useful to the committee. But here's one question that captures that. My counselor has spoken with me about taking challenging courses. 10.6% said yes, 87.1% said no. Investment: do you have the habits of mind and the study habits to succeed in higher education? we ask this question. After finishing my schoolwork, I check it over to see if it's correct. 74.5% strongly disagreed or disagreed. 25.6% agreed or strongly agreed. I will tell you, as you get to the University of Minnesota, professors like these are not going to give you a second chance to revise it in many cases. Another question. I give up watching TV or hanging out with friends to study for a test or do an assignment for school. 66.9% strongly disagreed or disagreed. 33.1% agreed or strongly agreed. Remember, we had 90% saying, I want to go on to college. And finally, finally, Madam Chair, finally, Madam Chair, one point on access, the nuts and bolts of getting in. We asked, I have a plan for how I'm going to get into college. 38.3% strongly disagreed or disagreed, but 61.7% agreed or strongly agreed. And so we're really attempting with Ramp Up to Readiness, and President Larry Litecki from Century College is on our design team, and he continually helps us think about post-secondary education broadly, which is to say the knowledge and skills you need to succeed at Century College along with the university, and of course our private colleges too. We're trying to create a platform that we hope 2 years from now will be replicable and sustainable across the state. If I had to describe it, it will be a counseling and guidance program that will often be led but usually not delivered by counselors because, unfortunately, as you know, Madam Chair, Minnesota has the dubious distinction of having the second worst student-to-counselor ratio in the country.
Oh, I hear it's the worst now.
Is it? That's not a...
I have to ask Senator Wieger. He's kind of the expert.
That's not progress. And yet we know that counselors can be the hubs of this work if it's distributed differently within schools and increasingly within homes and community organizations. So thank you again very much for the opportunity to give you these snapshots of the work we're doing.
What a smart idea to survey the students.
Yeah.
It really gives you a baseline. So you kind of know where your efforts need to go.
And, Madam Chair, the staff surveys, which I don't have today, but those are very interesting, too. Mm-hmm. If I had to unfairly oversimplify the early data there, it's that we have some work to do with some of our educators about the degree to which actually they believe that our students can and should go on.
They didn't even know enough to lie.
Yeah.
Of course, I think all students can succeed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Except not that one or that one or that one.
Yeah, that's where we go. But we're really trying to build this such that it is not like a lot of programs, some of which are wonderfully effective, delivered by people outside our schools, but that it's something that a school can take and own, but that is research-based and is not sort of everybody's definition of college readiness.
Great. Thank you very much. That's very exciting to hear about this. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much, the three of you.
Thank you.
Then we'll move on to our last panel from the Office of Higher Education.
That is interesting. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Lou Dressbach, and I'm the Director of Community Outreach, Human Resources, and Agency Services at the Office of Higher Education. I want to thank you for inviting us to provide some information to you this afternoon about our agency's early college awareness and access programming.
So, Ms. Dressbach, is Mr. and Ms. Akanis over helping Ms. Hegard in the house?
Actually, Mr. and Ms. Akanis is in another meeting and apologize for not being able to be here, so I'm pinch hitting here. Before I begin, I wanted to, Madam Chair and members of the committee, apologize to you for the tardiness of the Intervention for College Attendance Grant Program report. The report was due the middle of January, and we realized that the report was going to be delayed, and we did not inform you in a timely manner.
And I've been looking for it every day. I've been checking my mail.
Well, that's what we thought. So we finally did get it to you this week. We apologize for any inconvenience that this has caused you, and if you have any questions related to the report, we would be happy to have staff meet with you individually or respond to written questions about the report. I'm going to start this afternoon with the Get Ready program, and you should have a handout that has a packet and a large chart. And if you take the chart and open it up and have the Get Ready program in the upper left-hand corner, that's where we're going to start. We received a number of questions in advance of our presentation this afternoon, and we've attempted to answer the questions either with our handouts or with the presentation that we're giving. The Get Ready program is the agency's largest early college awareness and planning program. My colleague Nancy Walters, to my left, will describe several other programs administered by the office, and then we'll briefly talk about some other things that we have going on related to planning and student information.
And Ms. Dresbeck, this is primarily federally funded, right?
Yes, I will get to that. The Get Ready program is primarily funded through a federal Gear Up grant. The Get Ready program targets low-income students, students of color, and those with no prior experience with post-secondary education. And it's an early college awareness program. When we talk about college, or when I mention that word, we mean that in the very broadest sense. We mean it as any post-secondary education beyond high school, whether it be two-year, four-year, private, public, or non or for-profit institutions. In the direct service component to the Get Ready program during the current 2008-2009 school year, we have 21 staff working in 11 St. Paul and Minneapolis elementary, middle, and high schools. The names of the schools and their locations are indicated in the table. In addition to the direct service schools, Get Ready Outreach provides some program services to interested schools or organizations serving the target populations through the throughout the state. The Get Ready program is funded primarily through a federal Gear Up grant, and that Gear Up means gaining early awareness and readiness for undergraduate programs. The office is the state Gear Up grantee. Our current grant is $2.5 million per year, or $15 million over a six-year period. Our current grant runs through August of 2011. Gear Up requires a dollar-for-dollar match through in-kind or monetary sources. The current state appropriation to the Gear Up to the Get Ready program of $184,000 is part of that match to our federal grant. In addition, we have a small private grant that we use for matching purposes. And a significant part of our match does come from in-kind kinds of contributions to the program that schools, partners, and other collaborations give to our program. The Get Ready program is fairly unique in that it starts with students in fourth grade. During the current 2008-2009 year, we have staff working in grades 4 through 10. Program services include curriculum presentations about preparing for, planning, and financing a post-secondary education. We have career speakers come and talk to the students about what types of educational background they have for their careers. We take students, all students, on at least one post-secondary institutional field trip each year, and we vary the types of post-secondary institutions we take them to so that they understand that there are various options. We have an academic tutoring component, and we tutor primarily in the areas of reading and mathematics. We use program staff for this tutoring, and we have college students that assist with that tutoring, and the tutoring occurs primarily in after-school programming. We have one-on-one counseling and advising for our middle school and high school students. We provide scholarships for our students so that they can attend summer academic programs. We have a parent component and have regularly scheduled parent events at our Get Ready schools. We believe that the parents or guardians need to be active partners in their children's education and can be really cheerleaders for their children, and that's important. We support professional development for classroom teachers and school staff who work with our program. To supplement our program services and to provide another method of reinforcing the concepts that we have in our college planning curriculum, we've contracted for quite a number of years now with Climb Theater, who develops plays and interactive sessions that are brought to students in our schools that reinforce the concepts and the information that's covered in the Get Ready curriculum. One of the questions that we received from you in advance of today's presentation asked whether the activities of the Get Ready program actually support college attendance among the populations that we serve. We can say some things. Based on evidence in the literature about successful strategies in working with low-income students and those with little or no prior experience with post-secondary education in their families, the program services and activities we provide in Get Ready should support increased college enrollment for the students we serve. Like I said, our oldest student cohort is in the 10th grade this year, so it's going to be another couple of years until we know exactly how successful we are in our efforts with that cohort. In an attempt to continuously improve the program, however, and to be good stewards of public funds, we have contracted with two organizations through a competitive process to work collaboratively with Get Ready evaluation staff on two different types of outside evaluation projects. The first is a longitudinal study which will help to determine the relationship between Get Ready activities, student perceptions and attitudes, and student academic outcomes. The study's design includes surveying students over time and analyzing these results in conjunction with information about student participation in Get Ready activities, services, and academic outcomes. The design will incorporate comparison groups of students who do not participate in Get Ready programming. The second evaluation project is a cost-benefit, cost-effectiveness study. The cost analyses will identify the social benefit of Get Ready activities from a monetary perspective as part of a process for determining the effect of the Get Ready program. To our knowledge, this is the first cost-benefit, cost-effectiveness study of any federal Gear Up program, and that study is being done by the Wilder Foundation. Finally, you asked us to identify the strengths and challenges of the Get Ready program. Some of our strengths are that we're in 11 Minneapolis and St. Paul schools, and Get Ready staff are working directly in the schools during the school day with classroom teachers and school staff. They're a part of the staff and part of the school community. We've developed partnerships with the school personnel based on mutual respect and support, which has been key in working effectively with students. Program services are delivered both during the day and after school. We provide academic tutoring in reading and math, which are two critical subject areas if students are to be academically successful. Get Ready staff work side by side with our Get Ready College Corps tutors. These are college students from our local colleges who come in during this the after-school programming to help students in these two subject areas. The Get Ready curriculum and services are fairly comprehensive. We are unique in that we start with students in the fourth grade. Our curriculum addresses some of the state standards that teachers must cover with students, so the curriculum is very receptive to classroom teachers. Lastly, most of our Get Ready staff are either licensed teachers or licensed school counselors. This adds credibility to the program and the services we provide. We have some challenges. There's a high mobility among the students and families that we serve. We have volatility in our matching resources. We have to match the federal grant dollar for dollar. And particularly with the economic times that we're in, we're expecting that this may be an even greater challenge. There are turnovers periodically in the staff and classroom teachers at the schools that we work in because the schools are fairly high in free and reduced lunch, and oftentimes teachers prefer to go to a school with a little bit less challenge. So we have to acclimate new staff to the program and what the program's trying to do. Under the federal Gear Up grant, we can only work with schools that have 50% or more free and reduced lunch eligibility. And yet there are a number of schools in our state that are very high free and reduced lunch eligible, but it's less than 50%. We feel that we have an obligation as a state entity to serve the needs of all of our students and all of our families. So we try to do that as best we can by leveraging fairly limited resources. Before I turn it over to Nancy Walters, I just want to point a couple other pieces of information you have in your packets. The first sheet that follows the chart is a breakout, and this was in response to one of your questions, of the student population in the direct in the schools that we directly serve students. It includes that by the name of the school. And on the reverse side is a map of the schools and organizations and where they're located in the state that are currently participating in our Get Ready Outreach program.
Mr. Esbeck, are you only in 11 schools because that's basically the limit of what you think you can do with the money you have from the
fund? Yes. It is fairly labor intensive. And we have actually in response to we were planning on just following our cohort in the high school. We were with our ninth graders last year into 10th grade, and our schools asked us, pleaded with us, if we couldn't please put another staff person in the school so that the current ninth graders would have advising and counseling support. So we checked with our federal contact, and we were able to do that. So they were very pleased. There are two pieces that we use. There are two brochures in your packet. They look rather similar. The first one is a parent's guide to paying for college, and this includes information about how we call it the seven ways to pay in Get Ready. It includes information about financial aid and the different types of ways that a student and their families can cover college costs. And then the other publication, which is a little bit thicker, is a parent's guide to preparing your student for college. And it includes all kinds of information, like what kinds of classes the student should take, how a parent can be helpful as a homework helper and not necessarily know how to do the work, but to provide some support systems and resources for the student, careers and types of colleges. So we use these publications. The staff uses them in the parent events, and they create a variety of presentations that are given to parents at in conjunction with conferences or other events at the school and events that they specifically plan. I don't know if you want me to answer questions
Madam
about
Chair?
The Get Ready program now before we move on.
Madam Chair, is it appropriate to ask about the intervention for college attendance program?
That's next.
That's coming up.
So
that's next on the.
Okay.
Right, Ms. Walters.
But
is going to talk
maybe then, but still on this, are any charter schools involved?
There are currently just a couple charter schools that are involved, and we just, this isn't a charter school. We have talked to. Gene Piccolo with the Charter School Association, and he was making his schools aware of the program also. And we just found out last week that the Campfire Girls of Minnesota are going to be using the Get Ready curriculum with their after-school programming in conjunction with the Minneapolis School District.
Good. And Madam Chair, particularly for the charter schools, that's nearly 30,000 students, but a number of those schools are exclusively people of color, high poverty, and
we
would
are
hope
in,
there'd be that outreach.
One that comes to mind is the Hmong Academy is using the program, and okay. And we have an outreach associate that is continuing to contact schools, and right. We send information and then follow up. So we're working on that piece of it, and we'll continue to do so.
Mr. Esbeck, on your map of schools that are involved in the statewide outreach program, do these schools initiate this, their involvement, or do you reach out to them?
We do both. Mm-hmm. We get some referrals. We have some schools, like Manoman has been participating in Get Ready Outreach for several years now, and we've gotten some referrals from their participation. Duluth is an area that we've been in for quite a number of years. We have done direct mailings and then done follow-ups. We're still trying to find our outreach associate tries to, when she goes out to schools that are looking to implement the program, she then tries to visit schools in that vicinity and drop in and try to catch somebody and talk to them, because administrators get so much information that if you just mail it to them, it goes in a stack with, and they have the best of intentions, but they just don't get to it. So we have to use a variety of methodologies to try to make it make them aware of the program and the opportunity.
Okay. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. If you said something to this, I missed it. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I noticed that the LifeWork Planning Center is identified in your overall map, and that's not a school.
No, it's not.
So,
there are schools and organizations. Like I said, the Campfire Girls have contacted us. We have some outreach happening with the Girl Scouts. Organizations, if they serve the target population or have programs that serve the target population that we're trying to reach with the Get Ready program, they certainly may use the curriculum, and we encourage them to do so, and we will provide the curriculum to them.
Why don't we hear from Ms. Walters, and then at the end we can go back to some
sure.
of the other questions.
Senator, Senator Pappas, committee members, I just want to give you an overview of a number of other programs that our office administers to support access for students to college. And to make up for the lateness of the ICAP report that you received, I have multiple copies, so you can take multiple copies home and place them in different rooms in your house so that
we'll do that.
Be brought up to date. But first, I want to talk about the Intervention for College Attendance Program. And it's described on the 11 by 17 handout, the chart that you received. And this program, the intent of this program is, again, to help students be better prepared for college so that they're successful in college. And there are a variety of programs, and they support students in grades 6 through 12 and also support retention efforts of some students in high schools. Again, the packet that you received, the first map in the packet, shows where the Intervention for College Attendance sites are in the state for this fiscal year. The front side of the map shows the sites. And then if you'll flip that map over, you'll see the listing of projects that we have for this biennium. And these projects, as I said, they vary. The projects, in fact, you've heard reference to some from people who spoke about the University of Minnesota and Minscu programs, because we support some trio efforts. We support individual efforts like the University of Minnesota's, their program to support American Indian students, American Indian male students in St. Paul Public Schools. So these programs vary, and we do have a representation from all over the state. The outcomes of the programs, the outcomes are also specific to the particular program design. But following the guidance of the state statute, all programs focus on increasing high school graduation rates and increasing college participation. And we've had some very good success in these areas. For example, one program here in St. Paul, Concordia College, working with African-American male students from Central High School. They had a hunt for their participants. Their high school graduation rate was higher than the state's for African-American males, higher than the state's and higher than the district's. And we have similar outstanding outcomes for other projects as it relates, as I indicated, for American Indian males or for Latino students. And the success of the program can also be, is also reflected by the scholarships that students receive as they move on to college. And this is reported in the report that you received, and scholarships have been received by students, for example, for the University of Chicago, or by our support for Admissions Possible students. You know, they have a very, very high college participation rate, but they're very successful in obtaining scholarships to support them through college. The programs, as I said, vary. We have some very good, some impressive outcomes. for our projects, and I can answer any questions about outcomes. The challenges for the Intervention for College Attendance Program, again, something you heard this morning. The mobility of the students, it is a problem for the project directors often to track students so that they can document high school graduation rates and how they move on to college. And then again, our projects that work with students starting in sixth and seventh grade, you know, it takes time for them to get to 12th grade and graduate, so they are unable to report on high school graduations because some of their students are just in ninth grade. Other challenges that we have, some of our project directors, the challenge again, but we can understand, access to student data, because they have to be compliant, they have to comply with regulations regarding FERPA and other regulations regarding who has access to student data. Another challenge, the large number of requests that we receive for program support. For the last funding competition, there were 49 proposals submitted, requesting $1.7 million. We awarded grants of less than $700,000, and those grants were supported by $446,000 in ICAP funding and some additional money made available from the Achieve Scholarship Program. So that is a challenge, but a very successful program even with those challenges. The second program that I want to talk about, and that's reflective of the second map that you receive, and this map is reflective of our federal College Access Challenge Grant Program. And for the federal College Access Challenge Grant Program, we use those funds to support the current infrastructure in our schools. We wanted to be able to support the counselors that we do have in our schools, and reference was made earlier to the fact that we only have about one counselor to 800 students. So we wanted to support those counselors specifically in their efforts to advise and support students in preparing for college. So with the Federal College Access Challenge Grant Program, the activity that's reflective of this map, we wanted to provide them with web-based comprehensive counseling services. And this is being done through the Naviance program. Now, the map that you have was prepared January 12th, and it shows the school sites that had signed up to participate at that time. If you look at the back of the map, the listing of schools that have signed up as of yesterday are indicated. I didn't have the front side of the map updated because tomorrow is the deadline for schools wanting to sign up to be supported by the Naviance software.
You don't have a capacity issue?
We have, no, we're able to, but it's, they sign up for a year of service. Uh-huh. And since the school year has already started, if we keep saying you can sign up, it'll be the end of the school year for them.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So we're going to support schools who sign up by tomorrow. And then our intent is to continue to work with those schools and help them receive more of the components of the Naviance software. So that's one of the main activities under the College Access Challenge Grant. But we have other activities as well, training that's being provided for counselors, professional development so that they're better able to use Naviance, professional development so that they're better able to use the data generated by students. And we know that it's very important for all of us to have a better understanding of how data can inform our guidance and our guidance to students and the choices students make about post-secondary education. So that's just a little bit about the Federal College Access Challenge Grant Program.
How many years is that for?
The funding is available for 2 years. It's only a 2-year program. We can carry the funding over for a third year. So we should have access to approximately $640,000 for each year over a 2-year period.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Senator Babbitt.
Senator Sharon.
In terms of, this is the number of schools showing an interest in this. How are the schools aware of this opportunity? What are we doing to make sure that schools throughout the state are aware of the opportunity?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Walters.
Okay. Senator Pappas, Senator, we've done a number of things to get the word out to them. The program, the way we set the program up, schools have to have at least a half-time counselor working in the school. They also have to have 30% higher free and reduced price lunch student population. We advertised through their professional organizations. We sent information out to schools directly. We've done a lot to get information specifically to the high schools, the middle schools, and to the counselors by emails, by their professional organizations, the Minnesota School Board Association, every professional organization that we could think of, and every email, every mailing list that we could manage to get access to via email or by regular mail.
The Naviance? Could you tell us a little bit more about what the Naviance counseling software is?
The Naviance, Senator Pappas, the Naviance counseling software gives counselors the opportunity to do a better job of managing their own work as counselors. It allows them to communicate directly with students, students' families. Students have the ability, as was mentioned earlier, students can do some practice testing on their own. Students can communicate directly with post-secondary institutions. They could have their transcript forwarded to post-secondary institutions. So it cuts down on much of the paperwork that counselors currently do, and it gives them just greater access and greater access to resources and a greater ability to communicate with students and post-secondary institutions. So it's a management tool and a communication tool. So that's just a little bit about the Federal College Access Challenge program, and our intent is to continue to support these schools over the second year because we want to make sure the infrastructure of counselors that we do have resources to help them be able to really do a better job of advising students about college and helping students get into college. The last program that I'll talk about and the last map that you have is reflective of the state program that we developed out of money set aside for the ACHIEVE program. And the statute for the ACHIEVE program indicated that our agency could develop activities initiative to strengthen efforts in the college-going area. So this last map and information on the larger, the 11 by 17 handout, give you some information about the Advising and Counseling for College program. Grants were awarded in March of this year. And the grant program wanted to and did place new people in school sites, new counselors in schools, so that they could specifically focus on advising and counseling so that they would not be encumbered by many of the administrative responsibilities that counselors take on to get students enrolled in class, to, supervise students, or to deal with some of the other social issues that students face. These counselors, these staff people were hired, licensed counselors, specifically to help students with advising and counseling. The grants that we awarded, and we awarded 24, the grants range from $10,000 to $100,000. And the grants for $10,000, and again, the project, the grantees are listed on the back of the map. The smaller grants, those sites really invested in resources for their counseling program because $10,000 was not enough for them to support a staff person. But the advising and counseling program, again, helped with staffing specifically for advising and counseling, and we were able to provide support for schools throughout Minnesota.
And how much was set aside in this pot for this?
We used $1.8
million
for the advising and counseling program.
And when you give these out, are these considered one-year grants?
They were one-year grants because we could not...
One time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We couldn't commit right. money that we that may not be there beyond just 1 year.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Senator
Wieger? Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Walters, for any students that would have been recipients of a presentation or direct, indirect involvement, was there a survey done to get their feedback as to on a 1 to 5 or 10, this had an impact to get some quality information back as to whether we're delivering?
Mm-hmm. Senator Pappas, Senator Wieger, for all of the programs, they're required to report their outcomes. Under the Intervention for College Attendance Program, the project directors collect information, demographic information about the students, and then from the students, so that they do get information on whether the students really, whether the programs supported students and their goals of moving on to college. So information is collected, and for the Intervention for College for a College Attendance Program, it's summarized in the report. For the other two programs, they're so new, the project directors have received their reporting guidance, but they haven't reported, beyond reporting their interim project status, they haven't reported true outcomes as far as number of students affected and what choices those students have made just yet, because they're in the process.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Walters, have the participants participated in a follow-up where they share information on best practices and then you publish on a website or something that other districts might take advantage of to share the insights that have been gained?
Senator Pappas, Senator Wieger, every year I have a meeting for the project directors for the Intervention for College Attendance Program. They do share with me their successes and challenges. We do not have on our agency website information that other people can automatically go to. I get phone calls and inquiries from other people, and I act as the person who gives them the benefit of what the project directors have learned, a past information on that way. We don't have a formal way of people inquiring. People know about the Intervention for College program, and they'll contact us, but it's very informal.
Well, Madam Chair, my suggestion is, you know, make it as 24/7 electronically available for people as possible, not only for professional colleagues, but for your audience as well, as they're tech savvy and you might get them that way. I was just curious about one other particular recipient, if I could ask that question, Madam Chair. I saw that Mounds Park Academy received funds for intervention. It's in my district. It's a great school, private school. 100% at that school go to college. It's a 20,000 plus tuition. But what was this about?
Ms. Walters.
Senator Pappas, Senator Wieger, Mounds Park Academy was the fiscal agent for Breakthrough St. Paul. And Breakthrough St. Paul is a separate activity. It's housed at Mounds Park. But Breakthrough St. Paul works with students from the St. Paul school system. Mm-hmm. They bring the students to Mounds Park over the summer for summer academic programs. And then some of those students, as you said, tuition, may end up going to Mounds Park. But their intent is through their summer program for St. Paul students to have them better prepared for high school. And again, it's been a very successful program. Recently in the newspaper, two of the students from Breakthrough St. Paul, St. Paul middle school students, received full financial aid awards from the Kent Cook Foundation in Virginia. So it is a program for St. Paul Public School students, but they use the facilities at Mounds Park, and Mounds Park is the fiscal agent.
So they are breaking through St. Paul over to Maplewood.
Yeah, it is a St. Paul public school system program. Yeah,
we need to wrap up, but could you just tell us briefly about the Middle School Outreach Collaborative?
The Middle School Outreach Collaborative, Senator Pappas and members of the committee, is a collaborative project that was initiated by the Higher Education Advisory Council, which is the executives of the university, President Brunix, Chancellor McCormick, David Laird from the private colleges, and our agency, where they had this idea that they wanted to do something to support college readiness and participation. And so on the yellow sheet in your packet, there's a summary about the program. It's commonly known to people as the I Make It Happen. You may have heard of that. I did notice that we don't have the it has its own website, and it's not on the chart or on this yellow piece of paper, I do not believe. The website is www.imakeithappen.org. The website was designed to be attractive to students in grades 7 through 9, so it's very different than our agency websites and appeals to that age group of students. The website, in addition to having the website, there is an online counselor. Students can email the counselor with questions or call. And we have a licensed school counselor that responds to those questions of students. There's outdoor advertising. This year they contracted with Climb Theater, the same ones that the Get Ready program uses for its theater productions. And Climb created a play, Power to the Eighth, that's been going around to middle schools in the state and has had very good reception with students. And then the actor educators from Climb go into the classrooms and have conversations with the students about the concepts and the ideas brought up in the play. It's a great collaboration. We're hoping that the members that have been have made financial commitments, and that information's on your sheet, all are very supportive of it and hope to continue this. And it's gotten some great response from students. They do certain things. They can get a college T-shirt or a pen or whatever. So there are some small rewards for going on the website and doing certain things to encourage them to start thinking and taking action to be successful in high school.
Is the TV spot on the website?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Okay, any last questions? All right, then. Thank you very much.